Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 102 of Registry Matters. Larry, are your arms tired because you've been flying all day?
They are indeed, but I haven't been flying all day. It's only an hour flight.
Oh, okay. Tell us where you're flying back from.
I was in Sin City, sinning.
Oh, wow. You were in Vegas, sinning?
Las Vegas, Nevada.
And you were there for what reason?
Well, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, or NACDL, they put on continuing legal education around the country, and they've been doing this for about 10 years. They have a defending sexual crimes seminar in Las Vegas, and it draws 450 to 500 attorneys. So NARSOL, the National Association for Rational Sexual Defense Laws, we've been there for five of those. So we go and hang out where the attorneys are, and we try to build bonds with those attorneys. We need more attorneys to be in our camp of cooperating attorneys that we can work with on impact litigation. And what better place to look for attorneys than at a conference where attorneys that are in defense business of this type of crimes are attending for training?
That sounds legit. And did you make any noteworthy contacts with anybody?
Well, it's always hard when you leave there and people come up and are very receptive. And you take their contact, their business card, and you take their information, and then you have minimal contact with them for the next year. We put them on our email list and we reach out to them sometimes and they don't respond to us. But it's you keep trying because it's planting the seed, and they're seeing the logo, they're seeing the literature, they're seeing the faces there year after year. And we talked about impact litigation less. That's been our theme, about we want partners to do impact litigation. And that's been our theme, impact litigation, partners. NARSOL has funding, limited funding for assistance with impact litigation. So we're hoping that some of those attorneys, that when they see something outrageous, that they'll think of NARSOL and say, gee, I'm just a solo or a two-person law firm and I couldn't afford to do this. But I remember I was in Las Vegas back in November and there was this outfit. What was their name again? They had money available to help. I'm going to reach out to them. That's what we're hoping happens, that we begin to be recognized as, when people think about civil rights litigation, they think about ACLU. And when they think about civil rights in this area of sexual offenses, we're hoping that they think about, of course, the ACLU, but we're hoping they think about NARSOL also. And that's why we're at these exhibitions, to try to become more known.
Can you give me a quickie explanation of what impact litigation is?
Well, it would be the litigation that would have an effect beyond the individual's case. So, for example, NARSOL probably gets a dozen a week of inquiries of people who have been convicted in the most corrupt jurisdiction in the United States, and their public defender sold them out, and they don't deserve this. And if we would just hear their story, we would understand. And we hear that, like I say, probably certainly a half dozen, but maybe a dozen times a week. But within that group of inquiries, you're looking for something like what happened in Butts County and Spalding County, Georgia, where you can have an impact beyond the individual. No one deserves to be on the registry and be abused, but the fact that a person pled guilty because the cop tricked them is not the same thing as a person who pled guilty because the cop tortured them. And I'm talking about physical torture. So if we find solid evidence that a cop tortured someone, then that would be litigation, fertile for litigation, because that would have impact beyond that individual. We would be going after reminders to law enforcement that you can't torture people to obtain a confession. So that's what impact litigation is. The things that we litigate that are going to have an effect beyond the one individual who's actually the vehicle that we're using.
I gotcha. Is that hard to find impact litigation? And then subsequently, is it hard to find an attorney to take impact litigation?
The answer to the first question, it's not hard to find impact litigation. What the difficulty is finding the legal team that can afford to do the impact litigation, because it's so expensive and time consuming, and it's going to drag on for years and be very draining on a practice, because as we've talked about on this podcast for the regular listeners, the governmental entities, be they state, county, or federal, they have virtually limitless resources to pump into it, and they can fight back at a level that very few small solo practitioners or even a 2 or 3 person law firm have. So the difficulty is not finding the impact litigation. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of things out there that need to be litigated that would have impact. The issue is trying to find, muster the resources to do the impact litigation.
I'm going to then, would you call the ACLU thing in Michigan, is that impact litigation?
Absolutely. That is impact litigation. That's going to have an impact on hundreds or thousands of people. And that when they finally resolve that, there's going to be an improvement in the lives of people who were required to register under those enhanced requirements of 2006 and 11. And they're not going to be able to reinstitute all of those, because the courts have held that they transformed the Michigan registry into inflicting punishment, and you can't impose punishment retroactively. So that is definitely a good example of impact litigation, but it was very expensive. And I think I've told the story that the fees as of the last accounting I had that had been approved by the state for the plaintiffs, the state was the defense, but the fees that had been stipulated to by the state of Michigan were $1.8 billion.
Yeah, I thought it was somewhere around two. Right.
Yeah. If that weren't a law school, and the ACLU carrying that, and the Michigan's one of the more affluent states, and the ACLU probably has a lot more money than say the Tennessee, the Alabama ACLU. And that they wouldn't have been able to carry that litigation for all that time. And then they do it with cooperating attorneys as well. And the cooperating attorneys get their money on the backside of litigation when it's finally paid. And they get cost up front, which is the kind of the model that NARSL tries to follow. We try to provide case cost and then maybe some modest amount of attorney's fees. But we basically ask people to work on faith that they'll win and be paid as a prevailing party, and prevailing party fees are not necessarily available except in federal litigation. Some states provide for prevailing party to be paid, and some states make it optional so they can recover attorney's fees, and some don't provide for it at all. So that's also a barrier, as far as there may be something that's very ripe for challenge, but there just isn't the resources to challenge it, because in this capitalist system we have, people like to be paid for the work that they do.
And shame on them. I can't imagine why people want to eat and feed their kids and whatnot.
It is kind of a horrendous thing to think about, that people that go to law school and have huge debts and have overhead, that they would actually want to repay their debts and to supply education and housing to their family and medical care and stuff. I mean, it's just appalling. They should be willing to take an oath. They should be willing to take an oath of poverty. Valid poverty, and they should work under that crushing debt that they have, and they should do it for the good of all. That's what they should do. But the only problem is that's not how our capitalist system works. We don't put into it for the good of all. We're very individualized. It's for the good of the individual, and I find it kind of a little bit entertaining every time a person says, well, you know, a person gets a better lawyer if they have money. I say, they sure do. They do. They get a better car. They get a better house. Their kids go to better colleges. They wear better clothing. I mean, we can go on and on with things that they get better when they have money. I mean, why does it surprise you that they would get a better attorney also? What is surprising about that? Everything is better when you have more financial resources.
It does feel like justice should be economically neutral, neutered. What's the word I'm looking for? No identification there that the justice should be influenced by the amount of money of the person that is defending.
Well, but then again, then we have to have a debate about how do we achieve that objective. And most of the options that we have to put on the table is kind of like solving other problems. We when people talk about the biased media. And I said, well, do you want to put more money in public broadcast? Well, no.
No, hell no. You don't want to do that.
Do you want to try to break up the conglomerates that own the TV and radio stations? No, don't want to do that. That's anti-competitive. I mean, the same thing with this. If we all recognize that ideally that the people, regardless of economic status, would have greater resources, or at least more equal resources, for some reason or other, we buy into this equality mantra, if we were to do that, then we would have to figure out how to make it happen. And that would mean we would have to pour a whole lot more money into the public system, or we would have to restrict what people spend that have the private resources. And I don't see either of those being very popular. I don't think when you start talking about restricting people what they can spend, that's going to be very well supported by the general public. We say, well, you know, we're going to restrict you to $50,000 for attorney's fees because that's a reasonable amount, and you can't spend any more of your personal wealth for that. I don't think that's going to go over. And if we want to vastly increase what's in the indigent system, we've got a couple of articles talking about that tonight. If we want to do that, that's probably going to mean some tax increases. And we can never talk about tax increases because taxes are evil and they should never be increased under any circumstances. So I just don't know what the solution is once we buy into the notion that justice should be more dependent, should be less dependent on money. What are some options? I'd like to hear some that we'd put on the table. I mean, theoretically, we could file fewer cases, but that still wouldn't change the $50 reimbursement rate or $40 reimbursement rate in Wisconsin. We could file half number of cases. That still doesn't get you a better lawyer for the remaining cases, would it?
I think not. And before you drive off all of the remaining listeners, we should move on.
I think we've got three listeners still left.
We do. I think we have 3,000, something like that. This first article I picked up while looking over Reddit, and it's from a subreddit that I follow called Data is Beautiful, and I just wanted to get your opinion of it, so I'm going to try and describe this a little bit. So it's like a waterfall kind of graph, and you have some blue colors and you have some red colors. The red colors represent what would be considered these were justices nominated by a Democrat or Republican. So on the blue side, you have Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And on the red side, you have Thomas, Alito, Roberts, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. And the graph kind of sways left and right. And based on the overall opinion on which way the justices voted and whether they have leaned further left or further right as time has gone on. You have asked for in the past for someone to do some analysis of how the Supreme Court justices have ruled to try and see if they have always voted with their team. Have they voted against their team, and you know, what percentage? I thought this was possibly like a first draft of what to answer that question. And I wanted to get your opinion on this graph.
Well, I'm having trouble closing what makes it hard to view, but that's not exactly what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is within the 80 to 90 cases that the Supreme Court grants certiorari to each session, each term, I would like for someone to go pick the 8 or 9 or 10, because they're not all criminal justice stuff. They deal with all sorts of things, from border disputes between states to antitrust to environmental. I mean, I would like for someone to go through, and I'd like for them to pick those 8, 9, 10, 12 that have to deal with criminal justice. And then I'd like to have an alignment of how the judges vote, how the justices vote on each one of them, because it would not be that tedious of a task, because you're only going to be looking at a dozen cases out of 80 or 90 once you take out the stuff that's not. And I'd like to show people, because they operate under the false belief that the conservative justices vote with us more than they do. They vote with us very seldom. And the liberal justices vote with us more often in terms of the outcomes we would like to see. So that's what I'm looking for, is I want to be able to pop up on the screen and say, look, the Supreme Court looked at 8 cases last year that dealt with prisoners or criminal justice. And of the 8 cases, the 5 conservatives voted against us of 7 of the 8 on our position. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, I figured that, but I was just hoping that. So from this, it looks like pretty much everybody has stayed in their camp, and they have, the Team Red has seemed to slightly move left, but Team Blue has moved decidedly to the left as far as this graph goes. But anywho, that was just my intent. I thought it might be a fun little exercise to play around with some graphs.
Yeah, well, now that thousands of people have heard my dream of an analysis, I'd like to see more analysis of the actual breakout, because as people yearn for more and more Scalias and more Roberts and more Alitos, I just would like to remind you, we've covered a series of decisions both in state and federal court where you've got interpretations that most of our people don't find very fascinating or agreeable. And these are the type decisions you get with those who say, I'm a textualist, I'm an originalist, you know, that's what you're going to get with those justices. But it's not what people connect the dots to. They think that when someone says, I'm a textualist or an originalist, that they're going to have those justices being anti-law enforcement, shut the SOBs down on everything, and that's just not the reality. So that's the analysis I'm wanting to see, because otherwise I'm just pontificating and no one believes me.
Yeah, I totally get that. I totally understand. Let's move over to the New York Post, where Chuck Schumer, he is the minority leader of the Senate. Feds haven't shared sex offender database. I mostly want to get your opinion of this. As I understand it, the feds would get all of their information from the states, because the states are the ones that are in control of their own registry. And so why is he all up in arms about the feds not sharing the information?
Well, I don't know, but he may be thinking of, he may rather be talking about the public registry. He may be talking about the law enforcement registry, the database that's contained in the NCIC of sex offenders. That, because if you merely relied on the public database, there'd be a lot of people that universities, not so much universities, but schools and daycares wouldn't be able to access that would actually be registered. So I suspect he's talking about the NCIC. They've not set up easy access for people to verify, for those entities to verify that the person is a registered sex offender in the National Crime Information Center's database rather than the public listings.
Do you think that this is a foregone conclusion that they will then open that up? It says Schumer also released a stern letter co-signed by U.S. Representative Adam Schiff. He sent to the FBI Director Christopher Wray and Attorney General William Barr demanding a reply explaining why the law wasn't implemented and a timeline for when it would be.
Well, I want to be a little bit condemning of Schumer. I kind of think he's grandstanding here. It's an election year, and this is a way to criticize the Department of Justice and try to gain political points. And Schumer, through his political career, he has been an excellent source of doing that type of thing. And in fact, those of you that remember the great recession of 2008 and all the banks and financial institutions that seized up and collapsed, Schumer was running his mouth off back at them about the insolvency of Washington Mutual, which they had not been declared insolvent yet. But he made a comment to the effect of that a person ought not leave their money in Washington Mutual, which caused Washington Mutual to have what certainly added to a run on Washington Mutual. So although I typically align myself with Democrats, I don't align myself blindly to Democrats when I think that they're grandstanding. I think that Schumer is doing a little bit of grandstanding here, and I don't mind saying that.
Okay. I will accept your answer.
Yes. I wish the other side would call out some grandstanding once in a while, but I see this as nothing but grandstanding. Changing, I don't know what's involved in giving these educational institutions access, direct access to the NCIC and how that would go about. But I'm thinking that's probably what this is about. And that's probably not a process they can institute quickly. It's kind of like the International Megan's Law.
Right.
It passed under Obama in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get it implemented before he left office.
Yeah, it's just now, just not, coming not in fully. With it, what, in the last year is what it's finally being put online?
Yeah, the markers and everything that took some time to do that, and so I don't think I'm ready to conclude that the Trump Department of Justice is stalling for no reason. I mean, they could be, but I'm not ready to conclude that just because some time has passed.
Right. So over at KUOW.org, which I'm not really sure what this one is, but experts worry active shooter drills in schools could be traumatic for students. I have a quick question. I realize that this happened after you were way past your school years, that there were drills in schools in the 50s and 60s about nuclear weapons being dropped on us, so kids had to get under desks and whatnot. I have to think that that would be something of a traumatic experience. Like, you have this impending threat of a big flash and, you know, the mushroom cloud and all that stuff. How would this be different to think that this wouldn't be a traumatic experience, thinking that you could go to school today and there might be an active shooter? Not a drill, but a real shooter.
So I was on the very tail end of that in terms of real life, the 60s when we were, we'd just gone through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the I started school in 64, so I was on the very tail end of the drills, and I was so young, I don't really remember it being particularly traumatic. They just had to, you had to get under the desk, as if that was really going to protect you from...
I know, right? It might help protect you from some stuff falling off the ceiling, but it's certainly not going to protect you from the blast and all that other stuff.
At my age, I didn't think a lot about it. It was kind of like the fire drills that we had, and I'm sure they still have, when the building starts buzzing and you're ordered to evacuate. And then in the 70s, we had a lot of bomb threats. You don't hear much about bomb threats anymore, but we had an awful lot of them in the 70s, where school would be evacuated. I think probably that would have been more traumatic, because when you're leaving the building, when that alarm goes off, they didn't tell you there was a bomb threat, but we knew that we just had a fire drill 3 days before.
Yeah.
And we had a suspicion it was a bomb threat. So that was probably more equatable to the drills for the shooter. And yes, we did always wonder if there was anything in the building that was going to go kapow. We always wondered, when they pronounced it safe, we could return, if anything had been missed, because in those days they didn't have all the gadgets they have today. Very few police departments even had bomb sniffing dogs in those days. They went locker to locker, and they used the master keys and opened up, and who knows if they were able to open all the lockers, or if they opened every 10th locker, or what they did, but we'd be outside for a couple hours, and then they'd pronounce everything clear and we'd go back in. But how thorough of a search can you conduct in 2 hours?
Very true. Let me take a quick detour. While you were in Vegas, was there some sort of hovercraft flying around, like looking for emitting radiation?
Well, there was a hovercraft. I'm not sure if it was looking for sexual offenders that were out of compliance, but there was a hovercraft, and I suspect it has to do with the increased security of the Strip and the thousands of people that are constantly there. I know the hotels put out what they said was a joint communique from I remember if it was just Caesar's Palace, because we were at a Caesar's property, if they said from the Las Vegas Hospitality Association, but anyway, there was a letter left in rooms saying that we're going to be checking the rooms, even if you put a do not disturb, no room service sign. If we don't see any activity, we're going to be checking on those rooms. So there was some discussion about how much privacy was being given up, because they were going to come in your room anyway if you have do not disturb. So I suspect all that's to do with enhanced security. So the hovercraft was probably looking to see if there's anything that they need to deal with. But yeah, there are hovercraft, and even in Vegas, that's not far from the Area 51, I think. I think there's a lot of hovercraft over Area 51, right?
There are reportedly lots of them. And then there was this whole, like, what was it? 3-ish months ago, there was a whole, like, a petition that they were going to go storm Area 51.
So
that would have been super fun to go see. That would have been amazing to go see.
But on major, go ahead.
No, I there were like a million people that signed the petition, and like 200 showed up.
But I think on major sporting events, that you find a lot of hovercraft nowadays.
Probably
that are doing various forms of surveillance with high tech stuff that we don't even know about that exists, that they're looking down upon the population with.
Well, these next two articles, one from The Appeal and the other one is from the Texas Observer, are sort of related around the same subject of how much we spend on indigent defense and public defenders. So the first article is from Massachusetts' highest court is urged to address the crisis in indigent defense. One thing that I plucked out of the article is the current rate of compensation is $53 an hour for district court cases, a $3 increase of the rate paid 10 years ago. That is a stellar raise over 10 years, Larry. I think that probably keeps up with the inflation rate, don't you think?
I don't see a problem with it. These people should be, I mean, if you're paying your paralegal $50 an hour or something, and you're getting $53 for the case, I don't see a problem with that. Do you?
No, that balances out. I mean, you get to pocket $3 for work that you're not even doing.
So this is from Hampton. I guess that's how they pronounce it. Hampton County Superior Court in Massachusetts. The Supreme Judicial Court had ruled in 2004 about establishing deadlines for if charges aren't brought, and if counsel doesn't enter, that things including dismissal will happen to the case. It says if in that case they ruled that anyone held pretrial for more than 7 days who did not have counsel had to be released, and anyone that had deprived of counsel for more than 45 days were entitled to dismissal of the charges. But now there's a new issue because the indigent defense attorneys don't have the resources, and there was a judge who said, well, even though you're saying you can't handle your caseload, I'm ordering you to handle the caseload and to enter appearances and represent these people at all the various stages. And there's just not enough of the bodies to go around, even with the extraordinary measures of trying to draft people into service. They don't have enough people to cover these cases, so that now the case is before the court to try to nullify that lower court order that said you will enter and represent these people regardless of whether you have the staff. Because remember, at various points on the podcast, I said, well, I don't know why they don't just stipulate and say, I can't do a good job. Well, they actually did that in Massachusetts. They stipulated and said, we can't do the job. And the judge says, too bad, I'm ordering you to do the job anyway.
At the end of the article, it says an article on last year's effort reported that a public defender in Northampton, I think that's probably Northampton, who joined the office in 2012, said he started out around $38,000 a year or $39,000. Public defenders are among the lowest paid actors in the system, earning less than court officers and probation officers. That's pretty bad.
I don't see a problem with that.
I don't want to try and institute any sort of idea about class warfare or this person's better than that, but a lawyer goes through an extensive amount of education, and you would think that they would then be rewarded for such. Probation officers, not to bag on them, even though we can bag on them for many, many hours of the day, but they, you know, maybe just high school graduates, basically. So I would think that we would reward the people that go to school and do all these things, especially the person that's protecting another person's liberty and defending them, that they would get paid more. But apparently that's not the case in the United States. We don't give a crap.
Well, I've said the same thing we've got police officers that we're always whining about the cops not being paid enough, and the cops get paid more here in my city than the people who defend, and the cops get their training for free. I'm not saying the cops should have to pay for their training, but they get their 12 weeks to the academy for free. They get their uniforms for free. They get their badges and their batons and their radios and all that stuff for free. The lawyer doesn't get, if they work for the public defender, if they have an office structure where they have a full-fledged public defender operation, but if they're in private practice doing contract work, they don't get anything for free. They have to provide all that stuff. They have to provide their uniform. They have to provide their telephone. They have to provide their computers. They have to provide their periodicals. They have to provide everything out of that money.
If you can take politics out of the equation for a minute, would it be a fair system to say that the defense gets the same budget as prosecution, or could you come up with some sort of, is it a 20, like they should get 25? Because there's all the investigators and other things that would go on the prosecution side that the defense doesn't necessarily have to worry about. What kind of ratio do you think would be fair outside of the politics conversation?
I don't know that you could ever do it that way, because everybody doesn't get represented by public resources. There are people who retain counsel. So you'd have to factor in those who have their own privately retained counsel. Some people privately retain counsel, and they have a hybrid system like we have here, where a private attorney can apply for expertise of the public defender system if the person can't continue to pay. So you have those things, but then you have all the intangible things that can't be quantified. The DA's office, of course, will have the attorneys and support staff in their zone, and they'll have DA's investigators, but they also have all the law enforcement apparatus. If you're a district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia, you don't just have your DA's investigators. You have the Fulton County Police, and yes, they have county police in Georgia. You have the Fulton County Sheriff's Office. You have the Georgia State Police, State Patrol. You have the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You have the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, you can go on and on with these alphabet agencies that they have that they can call upon for expertise that they don't have to pay. When you need an expert from the GBI, from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, you don't pay the GBI to come in and do the work and do the analysis at their crime lab. That's done. But the defense has to pay for that to have that analysis done.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that you could ever come up with a match that would be on the total funding. I think you'd have to look at it on a case by case basis in terms of the complexity of the case, and you'd have to look at what the state put into it, and you'd have to try to figure out some rubric to calculate all of the forensics that have gone into the creation of the state's case, and we'd have to commit to making the defense case somewhat on par with the state's case if we really were serious about being fair. And that, I think, is a long way into the future before we ever make that commitment.
Interesting. And then over at the Texas Observer, am I understanding this right, that there's a Sixth Amendment challenge being presented that the people needing public defense are not able to get a proper defense, so that's violating their Sixth Amendment claims?
Yes, that's so we have the blend of the two states, because we have what supposedly a liberal, progressive, enlightened state in Hampton, Massachusetts, and then we've got this Potter County, Texas, which I believe is in the panhandle. I believe that might be Amarillo or maybe Lubbock, but it's in the panhandle of Texas. And we've got a shabby system there where there's not adequate representation. So I don't know that we can run this red and blue here. I think that we have to look at this beyond the issue of the partisanship, because it's they don't come much more liberal than Massachusetts.
Probably not. Probably. And they don't come more conservative and red and all that than Texas.
Especially the panhandle of Texas, if I've got this right. I think this is where Potter County is.
I will agree with you there. Yeah, it does say Amarillo in there.
Yes. So.
Yeah, because you could say that Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston are going to be much more progressive or at least liberal versus this other part.
So, and the listeners out there, that if they have an idea how we can fund indigent defense, I'd be delighted to hear it, because we know that the traditional options that came to my mind are not viable options. So what can we do?
Let's move over to WOWKTV. Wawook. I don't know. This is in West Virginia. This is a TV station outfit, and they interviewed a polygrapher, and the title of the article is "How Do Lie Detectors Actually Work?" And first of all, the ATSA conference that was in Atlanta a week or so ago, my understanding is from talking to some of our friends that went to the conference that about 50% of the treatment providers think that polygraphs are a legit way to keep track of people being compliant, that they think it's real science. And this guy here is saying that, oh, this thing actually works. And he hooks you up to the machine, and the machine monitors your physiology. And what I captured from him at the very end was he said, after the polygraph was over and he detected that the person he was interviewing had some deception showing, and he starts talking to him, and the guy keeps making some sort of gun gesture. And he said, so now the guy admitted to doing something with some sort of crime involving a gun. So the polygraph didn't really work. It was him intimidating and interviewing him after the fact that got him to admit to having a gun. These things are complete bunk, and I hate these things to death, Larry. And it drives me crazy that our people pay, you know, $200, $250 to take a polygraph to show whether they're compliant or not. It drives me crazy.
$300 to $350 to $400, on and on. That
drives me crazy.
They're going to keep doing it as long as it works. And although it doesn't work in the way that I once used to have more faith in, that it worked as far as the actual science of it, the actual emotions of it still do work, because people continue to confess after they're shown the graph that says you've been deceptive. So if something continues to work, why would they stop using it?
I do understand. You know, it's the psychology of it. And so if you don't believe that the kabuki machine works, then you won't be susceptible to the kabuki machine working. God, I can't even say that word.
Well, at the NACDL, I sat in on two of their sessions, and one of them was about police interrogation and confession. And there again, they broke down the read, which I have not even, I thought I was somewhat informed about police procedures, but the read interrogation techniques, I have not had any training in that. And this very good presenter went through that, and she showed how they break people down and how that they get people to give false confessions, and how the retraining results in false confessions. Again, they're going to keep doing this as long as when they say you have the right to remain silent, that should end the conversation, but it doesn't. 99.8725% of the people have conversations with the police.
Yes, because because like, hey, the police are your friend. They're going to help you get out of this. Like, you know, so we have this sub-level of implicit trust that the people are there to help you win. By golly, they are not.
Well, that's clearly not the case. They are from the government, and they are not there to help you.
They have their own agenda.
So, well, it was a good presentation, and she was a great presenter. And I plan on getting the PowerPoint from her to look at it further and probably read the book about the reading.
Very good.
But yes, it will. Polygraphs work because people let them work.
Fair enough.
And it's like when the law enforcement comes to your door and says, you have nothing to hide. Do you mind if I enter? Why does that continue to work?
Because we want to be compliant. And people say, well, if you have nothing to hide, why wouldn't you just comply, Larry? Why do you want to be a hard ass?
Well, and I will comply as soon as we finish looking at your house. Says you have nothing to hide. When we finish yours, we'll look at mine next.
Over at securitymagazine.com, I want to say that this is like an IT security magazine. I didn't quite catch that that's where this publication was from, because I've read this before. Anywho, this is, we're back to Senator Schumer. U.S. Senator Schumer calls on DOJ to implement better employment background checks. Haven't we been sort of trying to push back on the background check part of the equation? Like, you know, there's the ban the box kind of pushes that, you know, hey, your past is your past. Can people ever move forward? I thought that's the direction that we were heading in this arena.
Well, see, that's the hypocrisy of Charles Schumer. Now, he will justify it by saying, well, yes, I'm for reintegration and for second chances. But when we're talking about dealing with our children, we can't. It's a different standard there. That's what he would say. But again, Charles Schumer is grandstanding, in my view. He's grandstanding because 2020 is an election year, and he would probably like to be majority leader again.
Do you think that's pretty much what this is? Is this just him in an election year? Is he up for vote next go around?
I'm not. Don't know about his, and he's in no jeopardy in terms of his Senate seat. But he would like to be majority leader, and he's a loudmouth. He contributed to a bank run. That's pretty much a loudmouth.
I was trying to see real quick where he he was reelected or not.
There's not a and I'm going to use the jargon that the government uses. No depositor has ever lost any money in an insured account since the creation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, I did some very crafty wording, because people do lose money in banks all the time when they don't have insurance because they're above the deposit limit. But no insured depositor has ever lost a dime in a failed institution. So even if Washington Mutual failed, and it did. Nobody lost a dime, and nobody was going to lose a dime. There was no need for him to assist in a run on the bank.
All right, can you word that the other way? That I know you played word salad there. No, so people that had their normal savings and loan account, they didn't lose any money. The people that lost money were people that had the toxic assets from the mortgage crisis stuff.
No, people who had, for each depositor was insured to a limit of $250,000 at the time of the recession. I don't know what that limit was. It may have been $100,000 and they may have increased it, but no one who had an insured deposit has lost money. But if you had deposits greater than
the 250,
if you, well, like I say, it may have been only 100 at that time. It may have been raised to 250 during that. I mean, that deposit insurance limit has gone up continuously. I think it started, or at least in my life, it's been as low as $20,000, but it went to 40, then it went to 100. And I think during the financial crisis, they raised it to 250, but no insured deposit has been lost, but people have lost in liquidated institutions where they've had money greater than the amount that was insured. And that's a wordplay, but the fact was that he shouldn't be helping cause a bank run. So I've not gotten a lot of fondness for Mr. Schumer, although he is in the Democratic Party. I would be okay if someone else held his seat.
All right. Over at patch.com, which has got to be one of our favorite publications of all time, because they instill so much confidence that law enforcement is doing their job around Halloween. That's pretty much the only time I ever hear about Patch. And this is Operation Hallowed Streets checks on 5,000 sex predators. Nearly 5,000 sex offender compliance checks were conducted for Halloween as part of a statewide enforcement effort. I feel so much safer, Larry. I'm so happy that these people in Tampa Bay, Florida were doing this.
Well, again, look at they have the data down there. Look at the hours that were spent on this.
Looks like it says about 15, almost 1,600 hours dedicated to this operation.
I'm not a mathematical genius, so let's put the time in there. Usually these are overtime operations, but let's figure that some of it was overtime and some of it. Yeah, I think that's a fair number. What is the cost of that?
$64,000. I'm sorry.
So did I do that right? I'm not a mathematical genius, so I'm deferring that to you guys.
Yeah, so $64,000.
And I would be curious if in Hillsborough County, if anybody was hurt in car accident on Halloween, any children were struck by traffic. And of course, the difference is a lot of this money comes from that federal government that we love to hate, because for doing home verifications, there's federal money available. And although I hate that federal government, even these darling conservatives, they love to put their paw out to get some of that money from the government that they hate, and they say it's too large. And I've never quite figured that out. I wish a conservative would explain that to me someday.
So out of the nearly 5,000 that they did, it's just shy of, they found 118 people not in compliance. Like, okay. So this is people that didn't have their car registered, perhaps. They didn't have some social media accounts registered, because Florida does that kind of silliness. So this doesn't necessarily mean that they actually walked up on someone, to coin a phrase, perving on a child somewhere.
Yeah, it was probably a lot of technical violations.
Right.
And the registries have become so complex with so many onerous requirements and so many short timelines to comply that it's not difficult to be out of compliance. If you've got 48 hours in Virginia, I believe it is, to report a social media creation, you don't have a lot of time before you're out of compliance.
And even with that, you know, depending on the state, I think Florida has an online mechanism to do it. I don't know if Florida does or not, that you know, just go to a website and type the things in. It wouldn't necessarily be that challenging.
I misspoke. It's 4 hours, not 48. You got
holy crap.
You've got 4 hours, and then you've got 48 to 72 hours to report significant changes, like a change of a vehicle ownership or a change of an address or something. And sometimes you can't get to the offices. They're they're not easily accessible. So it's like the complexity of these. The more complicated you make it, the more likely you'll find someone else compliance.
Definitely.
Let's bounce back over to the appeal real quick. And, you know, I'm just going to have to let you drive this one, but it says you can be sentenced even if you were acquitted. So as I would then play this out in my head, you go to court and everyone, like the jury says acquitted, and then somebody turns around and goes, nope, sorry, you get some prison time.
Not quite like that. but close. We've talked about Rule 404B,
which is in the
guilt or innocent phase, and this is a corollary to 404B. But we've talked about Rule 404B, which allows during the guilt or innocence determination for evidence of prior bad acts that pass some significant test of being to help establish the motive and absence of mistake of identity. It's not for the purpose of showing your bad character, but if there's something unique about how you effectuate the criminality, that they would allow that to come in to show that it would be more likely than you. And then there's the rule that it has to, the prejudicial effect it has to have more probative value than being prejudicial. And so in the guilt or innocence phase, there's the potential for having uncharged conduct come in to help the court, the jury, find you guilty. Well, the same thing happens after a verdict, after either a plea or after a verdict. There's, for example, the jury may acquit you of four counts and may convict you of one. Or two, or the plea deal may dismiss four counts and you may plead to one or two. But then in the sentencing process, the judge can take into account the unconvicted conduct as long as the judge finds that it's more likely than not that you engaged in that conduct. So a jury can acquit you of the conduct because the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt and they don't find you innocent, contrary to your belief. They don't say that Andy didn't do this. What they say is the state of Georgia did not meet their burden to show that Andy did this beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's on a very tough standard. If you lower that standard down to preponderance, which is just tipping the scale slightly more than 50%, that same jury might have said, well, Andy did do it under that standard, but under the standard that we were charged with examining, he didn't do it. So the judge at sentencing gets to weigh out if there was a preponderance of the evidence, and then that can be a factor in sentencing. Now, it doesn't change your maximum exposure. So, for example, if the count that you pled to or got convicted of only carries a maximum of 10 years, the judge can't give you 20 years on the unconvicted conduct. The judge can't say, well, I'm enlarging your sentence. But what the judge can do is your memorandum of mitigation where you're defense attorney brings in all this good stuff that says you ought to be getting a very minimal sentence or even probation. The judge can say, well, I did consider all the mitigation, but also considered the factors of the other conduct. And I find that it's more likely than not that conduct was actually committed. So that's going to be a factor in the sentence. But the 10 years is still the maximum that could be given or whatever the maximum was for that count. So it doesn't enlarge your exposure, but it may cause you to get more time than what you would have gotten if the unconvicted conduct hadn't been there.
I see. I don't think I see. Okay. That still sounds complicated though. I mean, maybe
it is complicated.
Is the title of the article misleading?
Well, let's see. What's misleading about it?
I don't know. It says you can be sentenced even if you were acquitted.
Well, you can be sentenced for that conduct, but not if you were totally acquitted of everything.
So this is just saying you were charged for two things, acquitted of one, and then you get sentenced for the remaining one.
Well, and the acquitted conduct can factor into you getting a harsher sentence on the one you got convicted of. Okay. Because the judge doesn't have to believe that you're innocent. The judge only has to believe that you were more likely guilty. Because you were found guilty of something.
Fair enough.
But it doesn't enlarge the exposure. But there's an effort underway to change that. And actually, it has some bipartisan support here, if I read the article correctly. Did you notice that?
I did not.
This has got some bipartisan support to make changes in that. What are they calling it here?
Can you say that in the condescending tone that you always use when you say, oh, this got your great bipartisan support? Can you do that for me?
Well, I didn't say bipartisan can always be bad. I'm saying it can be bad. I'm not saying it's always bad, but just because something's bipartisan doesn't somehow magically make it good.
Sex offender registries are
bipartisan, or do you think they're good?
I do not, and they are definitely bipartisan, and they are not good.
So, when you're always panting and foaming at the mouth, wanting the bipartisanship, I'm saying, well, that isn't necessarily going to translate to good public policy. But the Supreme Court has already said that this can be done. So it's going to require legislative changes. But it says the Cato Institute, Due Process Institute, National Association of Federal Defenders, and Families Against Mandatory Minimums have all filed briefs in support of the petition, and there's good reason to think that many of the justices will be interested. Justice Clarence Thomas and Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined a dissent from denial and cert in the Jones case in 2014, which Justice Antonin Scalia explicitly called upon the court to clarify that acquitted conduct sentencing violates the Sixth Amendment. So it sounds like we might get another bite at the apple on this because I didn't catch this. It looks like it's going before the Supreme Court again.
Excellent. There we go. More stuff to watch. And we're never going to run out of material for the podcast.
It says, in addition, members of Congress are working to eliminate the practice. In September, a bipartisan group, including Democrats Dick Durbin, Patrick Leahy, and Cory Booker, and Republicans Chuck Grassley, Tom Tillis, and Mike Lee, introduced the Prohibiting Punishment of Acquitted Conduct Act of 2019. Hmm. So that is bipartisan, 3-3 in the Senate.
Very good.
So, but right now it can be done and is done.
So it is an ISB.
It's an ISB right now.
All right.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And over at law.com, we have an article. I don't even want to try and pronounce this name, but it's a woman sues Jeffrey Epstein estate on behalf of 3 sexual abuse accusers.
What kind of nut put this in here? Did you do that?
I'm pretty sure you did it.
Oh, I'm the nut that did it.
You are always the one that puts in law.com articles. I'm pretty sure we have a dead guy, as I recall.
The only reason I put it in here was it doesn't require a lot of talking, is that the high profile attorney with David Boies and the prediction that was made. I was one of the ones who made, I'm sure others, that there'd be a feeding frenzy with his demise. And this is just an example of the continuous parade of lawsuits that'll come out of the woodwork against him. Yeah. And they will dismember his estate. And it looks like Alan Dershowitz and David Boies are in their own dispute, and they've countersued each other. You see down at the bottom there, it says David Boies sues Alan Dershowitz for defamation. Dershowitz files counterclaims against Epstein accuser for defamation.
That just sounds like a whole bunch of lawyers making a bunch of money off of each other.
Well, but they're going to bleed the estate until there's nothing left there.
Right. I wonder if there's any way to shield a bunch of that money and move it elsewhere. You know, I don't know. Like, as far as I know, he's not married. I don't think he has a whole lot of family, so I'm not really sure who is managing the estate or who he would have willed anything to.
I think you should move it to the Registry Matters podcast.
I agree. I think this is a great thing. We should start some sort of letter writing campaign.
So I don't know how his estate is being managed, but I know that there'll be plenty of people that are trying to dig what they can out of it, and they'll be pursuing justice for those who were denied it for so long.
Over at the Daily Gazette, local opposition mounting to criminal justice reform. Where is this occurring? I don't even remember knowing where this is coming from. But Clifton Park,
New York.
Oh, this is New York. This is a widening coalition of Capital Region officials and law enforcement is pushing back against sweeping statewide criminal justice reforms scheduled to take effect next year. I am going to just throw out there that this is a bunch of blue people got elected to try and do the Larry Krasner move, and then the legislature saying, not doing that, and they're tying their hands. That's going to be my guess.
Well, this looked like an interview to me. This is an interview with, but I don't know who this person is being interviewed. But I did find something I found entertaining toward the end of the article, and I always say that giving the police more resources is not the answer. And it says, is the reform that you're proposing giving more resources to the punishment bureaucracy, or is it taking resources from the punishment bureaucracy and giving it to communities? and then he goes on to say, that's why, for example, you always need to oppose hiring more police officers, giving them more money for body cameras, increasing their budgets, even if progressive prosecutor offices. We need to shrink all these systems, and we need to invest in community-based and mutual aid and empowerment solutions. That sounds familiar. I don't know how you people expect there's going to be fewer prosecutions if all you do is constantly hire more police and you expand the apparatus. How will you reduce the number of people being put into a system if you are hiring more and more people who bring people into the system? Hello.
I think you need to work with the new math stuff. If you could learn the new math, then maybe you would understand why this would actually work in practice. Your old timey math does not make this work. New math would work.
Okay, so if we have 100,000 new police officers, are they going to drink coffee out in the community, or are they going to build criminal cases? I mean, they are in the law enforcement business. Which are they going to do? Drink coffee and eat donuts and go play baseball with the kids, or are they going to go out and make cases?
I think the coffee and donuts is a foregone conclusion. Then they're going to go make criminal cases.
but yes, this guy is saying a lot of what I'm saying. The problem is the system is actually working exactly as it was designed to do. When we say our criminal system of justice is broken, it is not broken at all. It's doing exactly what we designed it to do.
It is doing what we have voted for the politicians to put in place for us to have done.
And that's what he said here. We want extremely harsh sentencing in this country. We have for 25, 30 years. We've gotten it.
Which would lead us right down the path to the next article, which is from The Intercept. And the title of it is How Foreshadowed You've Had Done, I guess would be a way to put it. The criminal justice system is not broken. It's doing what it was designed to do.
Well, I think that's the article I was looking at. Did I jump ahead of you?
You did. We were doing the Daily Gazette with local opposition mounting to criminal justice reforms. But you read something from that article. Man, look, I got to get some better help, because you're not holding your own here.
So, well, I tell you, but I've got old timers.
I know it. But yes, this article is talking about how the criminal justice system is doing exactly what it is designed to do, and that is to be punishing and oppressive, and it is not rehabilitative, because the people. I say this all the time, Larry, and I think I've received some pushback from people, but we have voted for the politicians that have implemented the policies, and we have not told them to stop, so they are doing what we want.
That's what I've been saying. I did jump ahead of you on the articles. I jumped to that one, but criminal justice reform is going to continue to have pushback, which is what I should have said. When you brought the previous article, because we're threatening people's livelihoods, and we talked about that last episode. I mean, your PO did say that it would be nice to have a lower caseload. But what the PO didn't say is it'd be nice to have no job at all, to have half as many POs, because that's what we really need. If we're gonna talk about really taming this beast, we don't need smaller caseloads. We need a lower number of officers. And I bet if you go back and say, well, would you like to cut the probation supervision staff by half or a third? I bet you'll get a different answer, because he or she may feel that they're in that third, it would be cut. And people are not going to willingly sign their jobs away. We just don't do that.
No, we definitely do not. We could vote for us to have 50 senators instead of 100, but that would mean 50 whole infrastructures would go away, and I don't think anybody's going to vote for that.
I don't think you'd get a lot of support in that in the United States Senate. I don't think you'd get any support for that in the United States House.
But that's why we have, isn't the 27th Amendment is the one that they can't vote for their own pay raises? It's the 26th or 27th. Yes, the 27th Amendment, no law varying the compensation of the service of the senators or representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. So they can't vote for it while they're still in office. It would have to take effect later. So at least they can't vote for their own increase in pay like now, right? They have to wait.
Well, I think they've gotten around that by having it come automatically. Now I think they have to vote against it, if I'm not mistaken. I think that it builds around the CPI and like with other adjustments that happen. And those that know more can correct me. But I think now that they're raises, they have to vote against them. But they take effect the next cycle. But you're going to get reelected. 95% of the people that run for reelection get reelected in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, I'm sure they have figured out ways around it for sure.
Well, it takes too much money to beat an incumbent.
Yes, it does.
You've got an enormous amount of power and an enormous amount of name recognition. And again, we bemoan and wring our hands about, oh, there's too much money in politics, too much money in politics. And then you start proposing solutions. Okay, well, do you want to require public? Oh, no, we can't do that. I don't believe we should use the public taxpayer. Okay, well, do you want to force the broadcast entities to carry a certain amount of, well, no, we can't do that. That would be theft of their service. Well, okay, well, what do you want to do to get the money? Do you want to forbid people from having money in the campaigns? We've already heard in Citizens United, you can't do that. So what would we do if we can't limit the amount of spending and we can't boost the money coming from the private sector, from the public sector to match the private sector? And we can't confiscate people's entities that have, whether it be publishing or whether it be internet or whether it be broadcast traditional, if we can't forcibly take their resources and allow people to run using resources they haven't paid for, that they've commandeered, what is the answer? What are some options to put on the table? There's too much money in politics. Throw some answers out there.
Yeah, it's nuclear war. It's a constant escalation. So when one person raises 100, then the next one raises 120, then the next one raises 200, you could put in some sort of artificial cap, but then you end up with political action committees. And so then there's a whole bunch of other money coming down the pike and dark money and whatnot. And I don't know. I don't know what you do. I do not know.
Well, the thing is negative ads in politics work. And like we said earlier, they'll stop doing it when it quits working. We sit around and we bemoan, wring our hands about how we hate negative campaign. But you know what? We go and we'll hear something. We'll hear something kind of salacious rumor about it. Well, I heard that Obama did this or that, and I don't like that. I'm not going to vote for him. We vote based on just horrible stuff that's said about people that there's nothing to support. Oftentimes, it's just an allegation. Or it's taken out of context. It's totally distorted in terms of, well, my opponent voted for such and such. Well, they voted for it because in the context that you're not telling, that's why they voted for it. But they'll take it completely out of context. And if you don't have any money, you can't respond to that negative campaigning.
Yeah. Yep. How about over at reason.com? Georgia has executed a death row inmate without DNA testing the evidence. I definitely struggle with this one. So this guy was convicted in 94 for the shooting death of a store clerk. And I don't know when DNA evidence came into play, but so in the, 25 years since this occurred, I know we have DNA evidence now. Why wouldn't there be the willingness on the system to allow there to be DNA testing to potentially?
Well, what? Because it wouldn't have changed anything. He never said he wasn't there. He just said he didn't do the shooting.
Right.
And under Georgia law, it didn't matter because he was still equally guilty. So what the state of Georgia's position is that the defense attorney doesn't need to get the reason why you'd want that DNA, because if you could show that your person wasn't the shooter, you would be arguing that this person doesn't deserve the ultimate punishment because the two accomplices shouldn't get, the one who actually did the killing should get the more harsh punishment. So you'd be able to argue effectively that this person didn't pull the trigger. But it's not required under Georgia law that they prove. I mean, he was equally guilty under Georgia law, as I understand it. So why would you want the DNA? I mean, I don't know exactly what I just said, because he would have had the opportunity to argue mitigation, and it might have spared his life if that mitigation could have been brought to the forefront. But that the court took the position is he's equally guilty under the law. What do you want us to do?
Yeah, I guess I understand that. So the getaway driver is just as guilty as the bank robber, even though he didn't actually, quote unquote, rob the bank. Or I guess sort of by extension, attempted kidnapping is the same as kidnapping. You just didn't succeed at it.
Attempt is usually one level less than the actual completion of the
offense. Not in Georgia.
I don't believe. I believe an attempt will be a less serious crime across the board, but an accomplice to a crime, if you're assisting in the commission of the crime, theoretically, if two people are accomplice to a murder, it might not have been able to be pulled off with only one. So therefore, the accomplice is just as guilty, although he or she may have played a lesser role. They may not have actually been the one who did the deed itself, but they may have prevented someone from discovering the deed in progress and saved the person's life.
So you're in favor of the death penalty?
I didn't say that. I said that I understood. I understood. See, you're mixing. You're like the liberal do-gooders. You mix arguments here. The issue, this is not about the death penalty. This is about whether or not he gets DNA testing so he can try to mitigate his sentence. And the court said you had 25 years to do that. And DNA is wouldn't mitigate it because you'd still be eligible under Georgia law for the same penalty. And you're speculating that you might have got, the judge may have given you a lesser sentence had the judge known that you weren't the trigger person, but that's all speculation, right?
Okay. No, I agree, and I appreciate you explaining it that way, because to me, it feels like we should have done something more to afford the guy the opportunity to at least not die.
That's what mitigation would have theoretically done, is given him the opportunity. Under the law, he's not entitled to not die just because he didn't pull the trigger. He didn't have a claim of I'm entitled not to die. You're not entitled to mitigation. You're entitled to argue mitigation, but the judge doesn't have to find mitigating factors.
Yes, I do understand. Interesting. So, okay.
I don't know what it is about you people that you don't understand this. can you play You People tonight for people who haven't heard it? Do we have a clean copy of that yet?
I can do You People all the time, man. If you want to hear You People,
I'm talking about Perot's You People.
Oh, Perot. While we go over the next segment, I'll try and find a You People.
A clean copy of it. So
I was talking, I thought you meant the Larry version of the You People.
No, those who don't know that it came from Ross Perot.
Yeah, I will go find that while we're recording this next little bit. Because I want to hear your take on, do you know about this released to reoffend? News 11 investigates the sex offender next door. They say that there's a 99% recidivism rate. Do you know about this article yet?
I heard about it. Yeah, I was following the news. Yeah,
this is insanity of what this person has put together. And I only learned it today, but it came out a couple of days ago. And the Twitter thread on this reporter's account is overloaded with everyone that I follow saying that she is an idiot, a moron. Where did you get your facts? Everyone is asking for her to cite her sources and all this. And this is terrible. And this person is deeply, 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 deeply misinformed.
Yes.
All right, so we're going to move on.
I think that there's been several comments and reactions to the misinformation. And she said what her source was. It was some institute that none of us had ever heard of.
So she used some sort of kabuki source.
Well, it was a nonprofit, I think, in the area where the story ran. Because I saw chatter on the listserv about it today that she referred him back to a nonprofit. That's where she got her figures. And from probation and parole.
I can't, I play a lot with math a lot. And to have, later in the clip, she's interviewing someone and says that it says 94% happened by friends and family, you know, someone close to the victim. But I'm thinking, okay, so if 99% of the people reoffend and 94% are committed by a family member, like, your family would know about the things that you've done and probably be aware and keep you away. Like, those numbers can't coexist together that way. There has to, one of those has to give.
Yeah, which one?
I'm inclined to go with we have a mountain of evidence to support a much different number, like an inverted number. Well, I mean, I always hear 3% is a recidivism rate.
We know the recidivism rate when we take out the overblown numbers of technical violations that get grouped together. When a sex offender is under supervision, they'll say, well, we had a 42% violation rate. Well, the 42% of those, all of them except one, was simply a dirty UA, GPS monitor failure, missing a class, missing a PO's appointment, a whole lot of things that have nothing to do with a sexual offense, but yet they got hauled in on a PV and got carried before a judge or a parole board on a PV, and they didn't do anything in the way of a sex offense, but we have a 45% or whatever astronomical amount they say violation rate while under supervision, but they're not really solid violations most of the time.
Right. She got beat down on Twitter, but once the stuff gets in the public's ear though, there's 99% recidivism rate and all these people are out, like, we need to go hunt them down and get them off our streets. This is horrible.
It's really sad that as much information as are out there from governmental sponsored studies that a journalistic operation would be so irresponsible, I guess is the best word I can come up with to run this story, because if I'm the news director or one of the editors, I'm gonna say this 99%, that sounds a little high. I mean, what are we looking at for that? Before I let that air, I'm not gonna want a 99% number to run if we're trying to be so-called journalists and get the story right.
Yeah. Do you want to hear the Ross Perot clip now?
If we got a good one where it's not all garbled. Yeah.
It's this one is somewhat garbled, but we'll see what we can do with it.
Now, Adam, this sort of thing happens, do it. Your people do. Your people do. I know that. You know that.
There you go. There's your you people. It's not a great copy, but it's the best I could do.
That's where I got the started using that from when I heard him say it, because he took so much criticism, and I was wondering, well, he's correct in terms of the effect of NAFTA and what it did on the manufacturing economy. I mean, he was absolutely correct, and he was speaking to, I remember it was a minority group, but as we looked at it, it was actually NAACP itself. He was speaking, and he was like, I thought it was a little bit more style over substance when he said you people. I mean, it was not the most artful construction of wording, but he clearly saw what was coming, and that's what he was trying to communicate. And since he was not a lifetime politician, I think they probably could have cut him a tad bit of slack on that, but they vilified it for saying you people.
Gotcha. All right. Then our final article, and then we have some other comments and stuff to go over. This one showed up just today. And so Larry, you're going to give me your pushback, but here is an article from WREG. Seattle police captain arrested an own department's prostitution sting. This is hilarious. A Seattle police captain is accused of sexual exploitation after he was arrested in an undercover operation by his own department. Wow. I would think that the person in the department would know what the department is doing, and of course, depending on how big the place is, but like, he doesn't know that they're running a sting and that he's out, like, he's a cop. He probably knows he shouldn't be soliciting this way or exploiting this way.
Well, isn't Captain pretty high in the command
structure? I would think that's pretty high, but I don't know these things. I know what it is from the military side. I don't know how these things work in the...
I think Captain's pretty high.
I would think it's pretty high. I mean, like, you know, he's probably at least roughly in charge of the place. He's higher on the totem pole than he is lower.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. We've got a guy who made he's presumed innocent, and I would say that even for a police officer, and he's entitled to all the processes that he doesn't believe in for anyone else, I'm sure, and he's entitled to a robust defense and representation, and he's entitled to have this presumption follow him all the way to the conclusion of the process until he either pleads guilty or is found guilty. But it is one of those things where magically he will say that his entire 31-year career should not, that this one event should not define him. And I agree with that. I agree with him completely when he starts saying that when he asks for mitigation, if he ends up having to do a plea, if the evidence is overwhelming. I just wish that Captain Woolery had said the same thing. I wish that he had said the same thing in the last 30 years he's been on the police department. I wish he had said what I'm saying is that these people who make one mistake in their life, that should not be used to define their entire life, and it should not negate their entire career of work. And I just wish he had said that, but I'm kind of doubting that he
probably
did.
Not. We don't have a lot of evidence to support that the law enforcement apparatus, as you call it, it affords anybody else any sort of generosity.
Well, I'm inviting them by my comments to do that. I'm repeatedly saying that for them, and I'm inviting them to do the same thing. And I'm waiting, and I'm anxiously awaiting, but I would like for someone who's representing a law enforcement entity to say that people who get in criminal behavior, that should not be the defining moment of their entire life. Because I just said it right now about Captain Woolery. If he should be found guilty, or if he should choose to plead guilty, that his entire career should not be eviscerated, and he should not be, that this one event, this one mistake should not define him. So, Captain, another captain on the Seattle Police Force, let's hear you say that about someone who's been accused of a crime by your department. I would like to hear the command structure echo a similar statement.
I wonder, though, I mean, if shouldn't he be pretty much just found guilty since he was obviously arrested at the place where the sting was going on? I mean, that pretty much proves the guilt right there. They wouldn't pick him up if he wasn't, like, guilty of something, right?
Well, that's what the police generally say about someone they pick up, but I can't magically believe in that because my wiring is to provide person a robust defense. And as we know, we don't have all the facts. We don't know very much. We don't have discovery, and we don't know anything about this case other than this news release. So we should not presume that he did it, although that's what the police would like you to presume when they arrest someone and you do your little perp walks. That's exactly what you'd like people to presume, but that's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is.
I think I agree with you. Larry, we have a new patron from Lakeland, Florida, and they came in at the supported level, which is out freaking standing. And I just want to say thank you, 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 1,000 times over.
And who is that patron?
I'm going to leave their names off because I think if I even
but what are they going by? Oh, they don't want to, they don't go by anything.
I didn't capture it that way. I would say a first name, but it happens to not be just a first name, and it would be too specific.
Okay,
if
so
I said
Captain Crazy.
No, he's already a patron and he's in Kentucky, so we can't say Captain Crazy. But thank you so much from Lakeland, Florida.
All right. Thank you.
And we also received an email message from a listener, and it goes through four different points. But I wanted to bring up something about Patreon that people have asked in the past about doing like a one-time donation. And I realize that this is somewhat of a pain in the tuchus, that sign up to for whatever level you want. You can adjust the numbers however you want to do it. So you could sign up at the $1 a month level and give $100, and that would be totally fine. And then after that 1 month goes by, cancel your subscription. That's all you got to do. That would, because I don't want to give out my personal PayPal account information. I mean, maybe you want to give out your personal one, Larry, but I don't want to give out mine.
So, so a person who wants to do a one-time just does the one-time and then cancels. That is that the solution?
Yes, and it won't come out till the beginning of the month. They do their charges somewhere around the first or so of the month. So, you know, you can do it then. It won't happen immediately when you sign up. And then you just go back through and cancel it a couple weeks later. And
before the 30 days goes to the next cycle.
Correct, exactly that.
So.
And then I'm all sad because I see people canceling, and that makes me very sad.
Well, okie dokie then. I'll remember how to do that. I hadn't thunk of that.
Uh-huh. It works. Otherwise, then, Larry, we have a website. I'm about to do a big website refresh. I'm going to change the theme and all the stuff. I'm going to make it look all sporty and snazzy. But what would that website be for the listeners that haven't visited the website before?
Oh, well, it's we can't discuss that's classified.
Oh, it's classified.
We cannot
now.
Release that information. So, don't know what the website is. It's classified.
Oh, okay. So we won't discuss that. How about the phone number then?
Nobody uses it anymore.
So that's classified also. Do we have an email address that people could write into?
Actually, the person who sent the comment said that they had used the phone twice.
They did say that.
Left messages twice. So thank you for leaving messages. And the phone number is 747-227-4477.
And how about to send in some email?
If you'd like to send us an email, do that to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And as our friends in Lakeland, Florida, they supported us on Patreon. How can people sign up on Patreon?
That would be, what is that? Patreon.com/registrymatters. Or you just go to registrymatters.co and you'll find us there.
Yep. There are links there that will get you to Patreon. And anything else?
So if you go to the Registry Matters website, you can find anything, including pictures of our host.
Wait, no, that's not true. No.
No pictures of our host. I know I'm not out there.
I'm not either.
So
you can hang that up. Larry, thank you as always.
I thought when I got to Vegas about what a tragedy it was that I didn't bring any Registry Matters pins.
Yes. I could have also given you some other things. I could have given you coasters and stickers. They were given out at the ATSA conference.
Yeah.
I will send some your way.
We had an opportunity to, I mean, it would have been a little awkward, but we had an opportunity to spread the word, and we didn't get the word out to those lawyers. But we may figure out a way to do a follow-up letter and see if we can mention the podcast in the follow-up letter to the lawyers.
Very well. Larry, as always, I greatly, greatly appreciate you joining me. And if you're free, we'll try again next week.
All right. Thanks. And thanks, everyone. And good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.